Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
G'day, welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Chris Farnham and this is the podcast that looks at national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by Policy Forum and the National Security College at the ANU. This is our first podcast for 2019 and it is a special edition. We were planning a different podcast to start the year off, but recent events have brought us into the studio earlier. And I am joined here by Professor Rory Medcalf, the head of the National Security College at the ANU, and we are going to be talking about the current diplomatic climate between China and a number of Western democratic countries, such as Australia. Professor Rory Medcalf, welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Hi, Chris.
So let's jump straight into it. On the 19th of January, an Australian citizen, Yang Hanjun, was arrested shortly after his arrival in China. Australian citizens are arrested in countries all over the world, including China, on a routine basis. Why is this arrest different?
Well, I think there's obviously a diplomatic and strategic context to anything that happens now between Australia and China. This arrest was cause for concern for a couple of reasons. One is, of course, it follows so soon after the detention of Canadian nationals in China, which is seen widely as a kind of hostage-taking diplomacy in response to the extradition process facing a Chinese citizen in Canada. There's also the question about the Australia-China relationship. There was a sense last year that things were beginning to ease in terms of tensions. This brings tensions, I guess, to a higher level again. And there's apparently a lack of respect for bilateral agreements and the way this detention was carried out. There was a period of time by which the Australian Embassy needed to be notified of this detention and given access to this Australian citizen. Neither of those were honoured. And then, of course, there's the cloud over the decision to detain Mr. Yang, which, of course, relates to what was his crime. Is this to do with being a political dissident, being to some degree, I guess, an advocate of democracy? Is there any substance to the Chinese claims that this is about national security or espionage? And finally, was there something about the timing, which was also on the eve of a visit to China by the Australian Defence Minister? So a lot of questions.
So it's been termed in the media by a number of people. I think also you've mentioned the term hostage diplomacy. Is the central claim that China is essentially taking citizens of foreign countries hostage as an act of diplomacy to try and coerce other countries into taking China's national interests into account before they take their own into account?
Well, I think that is the case with the detention of the two Canadians, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, back in December. But that's only one of a number of possible explanations about this Australian incident. I wouldn't leap to that conclusion. It's one of perhaps three or four explanations we need to consider. There is, however, I think, a really worrying trend regarding detentions in China of foreign nationals and of Chinese nationals as well, but of foreign nationals, not only foreign nationals of Chinese origin, but now, of course, with these Canadians, other foreign nationals. And I think we're going to see, really in the year ahead, much greater scrutiny by not only Western countries but a wide range of countries about how do they properly caution their nationals or prepare their nationals for this possibility. This is a new risk on the international scene, and it's going to make regular diplomacy with China increasingly hard.
So you did mention that it's not just foreign nationals that we and the world is concerned about in terms of detention in China. That is actually a topic that we're going to be touching on in our next podcast with another colleague of mine, Professor Michael Clark, where we will be looking at the detention of China's Uyghur community in the Xinjiang Autonomous Region in Western China, or as other people call it, East Turkestan. This podcast, we're looking specifically at the act of detaining foreign nationals in what may be an act of diplomacy, coercion or not. We just don't know. Now, you just mentioned that the Australian response and the global response is important in terms of where we go from here. How has the Australian response been to not only the detention of Yang Hanjun, but also the detention of the Canadian nationals been, in your opinion, so far?
Look, I think the Australian response has been fairly cautious regarding all of these. I would like to see, a more forward-leaning response from Australia, particularly actually in regard to the Canadians, where we know the circumstances. We know really how unacceptable that kind of hostage diplomacy was. With regards to the Australian citizen detained, the Australian government is doing some of the right things. There was a public expression of concern. There were expressions of concern relayed privately by the minister to the Chinese government. Consular access has been pursued and finally granted. And really now, I hope, the Australian government is gathering enough information to form a view as to whether it should take further steps. But the bigger question for me becomes, how do we prepare other Australian nationals for this kind of risk in the future? In the meantime, the Canadian issue will continue to play out, and I think Australia can be a bit more forthright in really calling for the release of those Canadian citizens, not simply expressing concern about the fact that they've been detained, because in the end, a lot of the small and middle-sized democracies around the world are going to face potential coercion by China on a nation-by-nation basis. We're only going to have leverage in response to that if we work together.
So just on the Canadian nationals, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, these two gentlemen were a businessman and also a former diplomat who now works in a think tank. Is this arbitrary detention, hostage diplomacy on behalf of China, sending a signal to other business people in foreign countries or other think tankers and so on, that there is a particular risk in their profession of going to somewhere like China?
So I think there is an emerging problem here. I think the detention in particular of Michael Kovrig, former diplomat, now working for Crisis Group, you know, an international organisation dedicated to, objective analysis of security problems. That's someone who thousands of academics, people who work in think tanks, journalists and so forth can relate to. And so there are a lot of people who've built their careers around engaging China or trying to understand China who may be now quietly having second thoughts about the risks that they would face, maybe not in the near term, but on some future occasion if when they were visiting China there was a bilateral dispute between their country and China. And I do think that's something that individuals will have to take into account, and I do think that's something that will have to be factored into travel advice down the track. It's very sensitive, but I do think it's a possibility that wasn't on the horizon a year or two ago, that is of foreign nationals who are not of Chinese origin being subject to arbitrary arrest in China.
These are people who have based their careers around engagement with China, international engagement, global engagement with the country and its people. Are these kind of messages actually going to harm China's ability to engage with the rest of the world and be a global actor?
Oh, I think this is very harmful to China's ability to serve its own interests through engagement. It could hardly have picked, I think, a worse target than the employee of the International Crisis Group, because that sends a signal that if you're neutral and objective, but you happen to be foreign and you happen to belong to a nationality that China's having a dispute with, then you are at risk. And that really places many thousands of people who want to engage China into a situation where they have to think about whether engagement is actually worth it.
One might say that China or the Communist Party of China isn't particularly interested in objective analysis. Should we be looking at warning Australian citizens how to consider their travel to China in light of these circumstances?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with making our travel advice a lot more honest on this issue. If you look at the Canadian travel advice or the American travel advice to China, they explicitly refer to the possibility of use of, I guess, arbitrary powers, arbitrary arrest or detention. The Australian travel advice, it does warn about the enforcement of local laws. It does refer to the exit bans that China imposes on some foreign nationals, but it doesn't explicitly refer to the risk of arbitrary detention. And I think it's only a matter of time before Australia and a whole range of other countries, particularly Western democracies, begin to warn their citizens of that possibility in their travel advice. That's not to say don't go to China. It's a decision that everybody makes and takes on the basis of their own circumstances. But really, travel advice is there to ensure that there is that a duty of care has been served for our nationals. We can't help or rescue or get our nationals out of trouble wherever they are. And of course, sometimes our nationals might be detained for good reason. But we can give them fair warning in advance. And I think it's only a matter of time before the Australian government does that. And that will be politically sensitive.
Are travel warnings also an act of diplomacy? Are they more than just a communication to our own national?
Well, that's where it does become politically sensitive, because some countries use them for political signalling. Some countries read them as political signalling. But at the same time, when you think of the fact that there are a million Australians overseas at any one time, and our friends in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade are always receiving requests for support and help based on circumstances where perhaps if the Australian citizen had been aware beforehand, they might not have taken that risk. There's really no option but for the government to, I think, be pretty forthright with our citizens about the risks, even if that creates political sensitivities with a host government. At the moment, of course, Australia's travel advice for China is on the same level as our travel advice for New Zealand, Britain, Germany. Not places where you expect arbitrary detention to take place. Our travel advice for France and India is actually at a higher level, with greater levels of warning than it is for China. So I suspect this is going to change over time.
Just as much as I suspect that this is an issue that's not going to go away in the near future. Thanks very much for coming in and speaking to us today on the National Security Podcast.
My pleasure, Chris.
And thanks to Rory for coming in, having another chat with us on a pretty pressing issue. Something that I was hoping to do in our planned first podcast for the year is to introduce a new co-host for the National Security Podcast. You have heard from Catherine before in our Women in National Security podcast series, but we are now joined and will be joined for the rest of the year by Catherine Manstead. She is a colleague of mine at the National Security College. She is also a fellow at the Belfer Center at Harvard University. Catherine is a reformed lawyer and now a national security and technology junkie. Catherine, welcome back to the National Security Podcast.
It's fantastic to be here, Chris.
Now, I'm going to lean on your former law career here, and we're going to discuss an issue that flows on from what we were just discussing with Rory, and that is the unsealing of two indictments in the United States, one that is concerning the CFO of Huawei, Meng-Wan Zhou, who people claim that arrest of Meng in Canada and the pending extradition to the US is the reason for China's alleged hostage diplomacy, where they've arrested Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. There is a second indictment as well that has been unsealed, and this is in relation to espionage that is supposedly being carried out by Huawei. Huawei is the technology and telecommunications and internet company in China that is essentially being turned into a global pariah because it is being accused of either being a vessel for spying and espionage on behalf of the Communist Party of China, or at least having great potential to be so should the Communist Party and the Chinese government demand of it these actions. And so many countries are now divesting themselves of any Huawei technology or blocking Huawei from investing in their national critical infrastructure due to these concerns. And there has been a complaint that there was no proof behind these claims of espionage, or at least the high risk of espionage. And I believe, Catherine, that this unsealing of the indictment has basically changed the game. Could you give us a broad view to start off with what these indictments are about and what they mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think this is a really interesting contrast here. We were talking before with Rory about the growing and worrying trend of hostage diplomacy on China, on China's part, which is characterized by an arbitrary use of the legal system, co-opting the legal system in China to the purposes of the state, and kind of closed-door decisions that the international community doesn't have look through into. And then on the other hand, in America now, particularly with the unsealing of the two indictments that you just mentioned, we're seeing something of a sunlight strategy where the US is being open with some of the evidence that its intelligence community and Justice Department and other departments has assembled against Huawei. And we're seeing that being put out now into the public domain and subjected to the American legal process. So an indictment isn't just something that you can work up overnight. In this case, it took about a year for the evidence to be assembled by a multi-department effort led by the Department of Justice. But
tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With a lot of other US departments inputting into that process. And it's something that's now come to a head and is now out in the public domain. And I think that's it's a really interesting comparison for us to see at this particular time and with the context, the geopolitical context we're seeing at the moment.
I'd like to get to that big picture issue soon. Can you let me know what it was that was in this actual indictment that has really sparked everyone's attention or grabbed everyone's attention?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, there's two indictments, and the first one relates to the allegations that Huawei has been fraudulently avoiding the sanctions regime against Iran. And that's the case that the detention of Huawei's CFO in Canada relates to those particular sets of allegations. The other indictment relates to allegations that Huawei employees, at the direction and indeed behest of Huawei executives, were involved in corporate cyber espionage quite a number of years ago, actually, and starting in 2012, trying to steal some important technology from T-Mobile. And I think what is really useful and important about that second indictment in particular is that, as you've mentioned before, basically we've seen a lot of governments stepping back from engagement with Huawei. The US last year effectively banned Huawei products and equipment from being used in the US. In Australia, we had a decision to prevent companies under extrajudicial direction from being involved in the rollout of our 5G network, and that was widely perceived to be targeted towards Huawei. But so far what we haven't had is some fact base that can inform the public debate and the decision-making process about this. And I think that's really important that now we see in this indictment, we see allegations, for instance, that the particular acts of corporate espionage that Huawei employees engaged in allegedly occurred with not just the knowledge or tacit kind of acceptance of Huawei executives, but at the direction from executives at a senior level. And that indeed Huawei employees were offered bonuses if they could collect some good information and send it via an encrypted email channel back to Huawei HQ.
What a supportive workplace Huawei is.
Exactly. I mean, bonuses for good work. Yeah. But this is important, I think. And opinions differ. I mean, some people might say, well, you know, it's a bit of a limp response when you're suffering consistently from this high level of corporate espionage to kind of use an indictment and a criminal procedure against what is a really quite an important state-on-state dynamic here. But I think it's really good that this is now something out there. There's some facts. I mean, they're not proven yet, and the Justice Department's been at great lengths to emphasise that in the US system of justice, you're innocent until proven guilty. But still, in order
And that's in comparison to other law systems where that may not exist, possibly China.
Exactly. A good counterpoint to be made. But in order for an indictment to be unsealed, there is a process there. So a grand jury needs to assess that there's a level of evidence that meets a certain legal threshold, that there's a case to answer. And I think that's good for public debate here, because ultimately in a democracy, decisions even about national security, but particularly where national security intersects with the economy, need to be made, I think, with the consent of people and with an informed debate. And when you're making decisions, for instance, in Australia about excluding someone from the rollout of 5G, I mean, that's an important economic decision. That decision in Australia has real economic and business impacts for different interests. So I think it's important that we are able to point to, in the American case, these indictments to say, hang on, this isn't just spies and politicians saying, you know, just trust us. There are concerns here. There is some way that we can actually assess and understand those risks a bit better.
Yeah, and if you wanted to quantify exactly how this impacts business and society, in the last 24 hours, TPG, a large supplier in Australia, has said that they are now no longer able to enter into the 5G market to become the fifth provider in the country, simply because a lot of their technology was based on Huawei products, and now it's not feasible for them to come into the market, and therefore competition is reduced a little bit, and therefore you would expect that that means that consumers are going to pay a little bit more than they otherwise would. So what you're saying is that unsealing these indictments and showing the actual evidence of espionage against Huawei is in one part a tool to bring the public along with the policy to justify why we are paying these extra costs. Now, another way to look at these indictments is that, is it effective in terms of curbing China, or at least Huawei's behaviour? We say China because there is this standard belief out there that Huawei is a Trojan horse for the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government. Does unsealing this indictment and putting in train these legal proceedings, is that going to stop this kind of behaviour? How does it play into that kind of national security policy space?
First thing I note is the indictments don't specifically link these actions back to the Chinese government. It does link it back to senior Huawei executives, but it doesn't take it so far as to say this happened at the behest or even with the implicit understanding of the Chinese government. But I think, yes, you're right that there are questions over to what extent does this indictment or sunlight strategy affect China's behaviour or deter them from this particular activity. Certainly this isn't the first time that the US has used this kind of indictment sunlight strategy to draw attention to Chinese corporate espionage. So the first instance of this was back in 2014 during the Obama administration, when five PLA officers were, according to the indictment that was released, alleged to have engaged in corporate espionage. The jury's really out on whether or not that was effective at changing China's behaviour. So
it certainly got a great reaction from them when it was released.
Well, at the time and shortly afterwards, that particular indictment was credited with bringing Xi Jinping to the table with then-President Obama to enter into a deal to say, well, we're not going to do corporate cyber espionage anymore. I think, though, what actually happened was it was kind of convenient for China to sign up to that agreement at that time. And what they did, rather than ending corporate espionage, is they just got better at it.
Yeah, I think they moved it, a lot of it, from the PLA over into the Ministry of State Security rather than changing it and stopping it.
So arguably, they got better at hiding it. They also centralised their cyber espionage efforts, cyber corporate espionage efforts, so that they would be focusing more on what were determined to be priority industries for China rather than just kind of it being more of a free-for-all at a more decentralised level. So I think a lot of the optimism about the use of this indictment strategy to influence China's behaviours probably was misplaced, and the time has told that it maybe didn't influence China or deter China to the extent that we maybe thought that it would. However, I think the key benefit of this type of indictment strategy is actually messaging to the public and also to America's partners and to the broader Five Eye community's partners about the particular concerns and risks that there are with engaging with China. And to the US's credit, it's kind of a, if you've got it, flaunt it idea. They've got a good legal system that's reputed around the world for being something that has due process, fairness, that's a very established kind of process, and that is good at bringing facts to light in a measured and legalistic way. And I think that's a great way for the US to be able to be thinking about some of these threats that we see and some of the kind of more nefarious state actions that we're seeing at the moment, which aren't really at the threshold of war, but they're a little bit more than just ye olde crime. So how does a democracy respond to that? And I think the best way for a democracy to respond to that is by using the institutions that have served us well, by making sure we just don't reduce the debate to a secret behind closed doors. We have intelligence kind of messaging from governments, but that we are a bit more forward-leaning. And using those tools that we have, being the legal system, due process and other regulatory regimes, to try and combat some of this coercion and other nefarious behaviour that we see from China and from other state actors as well.
On a tactical and operational level, one of the claims for releasing this kind of information as well is that you're disrupting the operations of your adversary. If you can say to them, not only do we know that you're doing this, we know who is doing it, we know what offices they work in, and therefore we obviously know the tactics and the strategies that they're using to conduct this espionage. So if you're the adversary and you now know that they know what you're doing, you're going to have to change your behaviour because you're going to expect that there's going to be active countermeasures and active defence. So there is the idea that releasing this information disrupts their activities and it's going to make them have to change. Did you want to follow on thing from that? You can say, no, that's bullshit if you want.
Look, I think to some extent that's true. It's embarrassing for perhaps particular officials that have been caught out by that. I mean, a counter-argument, of course, is that by putting your cards on the table like this, maybe you're letting the adversary understand what activity is being monitored.
Is there any way the release of these indictments and may possibly even the arrest of Meng Wanzhou as part of the Trump administration's strategy and trade war to force China to readdress its trade relationship with the US?
So this Sunlight indictment strategy has actually predated the Trump administration. So during President Obama's term, this idea of naming and shaming corporate espionage and cyber attackers was first introduced. And so the Obama administration was the first to publicly attribute a cyber attack, for example, in that case, the attack against Sony Pictures to North Korea. And they were also the first, as we discussed, to indict in that case, PLA officers for corporate espionage. Certainly, we've seen an uptick throughout the Trump presidency on the use of this indictment tool. There's been a couple over the past year, in 2018 and also in 2017 as well. And it's paired in with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' broader plan of his China initiative to use legal processes and tools to rein in Chinese coercion and corporate espionage. But I don't think that this is something that is certainly not a White House initiative. In fact, it's not clear the extent to which the White House was fully apprised of the events that led up to the unsealing of these indictments. The legal process is moving differently and certainly not in lockstep with the White House. And indeed, broader concerns about Chinese economic coercion, about Huawei, and about cyber corporate espionage are shared across bipartisan lines. And indeed, I think many within the administration at a bureaucratic level and also many within Congress, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, would see this as a positive step and would in fact perhaps be a bit nervous that President Trump's impending negotiations over the trade war could in some way jeopardise or bring into question some of these legal processes that are occurring.
Yeah, I'm sure that there was a collective face slap across many departments in the US when President Trump suggested that he may use Meng Wanzhou as a tool to get a trade agreement. I can't see that as being an effective tool of diplomacy or even a tool of coercion for China at all. So I'm not sure if you've brought your crystal ball with you into the studio today.
I have, surprisingly.
Excellent. So can you look into it and tell me where you think, how successful you think this strategy of unsealing indictments is going to be, and possibly what China's response might be?
So I think the most important aspect of it, from my perspective, is injecting some facts that meet a certain legal threshold into the public debate. I think that's really important. Whether or not it changes China's behaviour in a positive way from America's perspective, I'm not so sure. Indeed, I think this kind of strategy of using legal tools more and holding criminal conduct to account might actually suggest that the US is more prepared to take on the risk that China will escalate in response to these things. But I think what's most important is that we have a baseline of facts and that we have a coalition of partners around the world who are willing to stand up to any country, be it China or insert other state here, when they sponsor or engage in criminal conduct, when their entities within their country engage in cyber attacks and they don't properly follow it up and prosecute that action. I think we need to be more forward-leaning on that as a whole, particularly democratic countries, and I think the US is starting a positive trend.
Excellent. Well, let's hope so. So, Catherine, thanks very much for delving into the details of this complex legal and geopolitical issue. And thank you for coming on as my co-conspirator at the National Security Podcast. We really look forward to hearing from you and interviewing guests and maybe joining in discussion with me like this in the future. And thanks very much for being part of the show today.
Very much looking forward to the forthcoming banter.
Excellent. And if you out there have any positions or opinions on what we've discussed today, or if there's anything that you'd like to hear us discuss in the future, be sure to get in touch on Twitter by using APPS Policy Forum or via Facebook at Asia Pacific Policy Society, or send us an email to podcast@policyforum.net. And we will be back in another couple of weeks to speak to my colleague Michael Clark, where we'll be discussing China's counterterrorism efforts and their social management policies in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, or as others like to call it, East Turkestan. We look forward to hearing from you then. Thanks very much for listening to the National Security Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.